You are now listening to Films for the Void.
Welcome to Films for the Void, episode number 66. I am your host, Landon DeFever, and joining me as always is the co-host who, no matter what the foe in his way is, be it low visibility, hot topic vampires, or God-fearing vegetables, will never back down from a challenge, the versatile Eric Spitz. Eric, how have you been doing lately?
I am so impressed right now. I really wasn't sure if you were going to find a way to incorporate all three movies into the intro, or I didn't know which direction you were going to take, honestly, but I am pleasantly surprised with that. And you found a way to encapsulate all three of these very eclectic movies into just a few sentences. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah, somehow all relating to Halloween in a very odd way. But you know what? This is what we do for our beloved patrons. So I'm very happy to lead that charge. Well, that, of course, was a reference to our three main topic movies of the episode, which we'll be getting into in just a second. But before we begin, did you know that we have a Patreon? Yes. For just $3 a month, you can access all sorts of extra goodies, such as early episodes, good conversation, and even the chance to pick an upcoming main topic movie. So if any of that interests you, head over to patreon.com/films_void. That's patreon.com/films_void and sign up today. Now that that's out of the way, let's get into our first ever Patreon request episode. Now, for a little bit of backstory, we decided to let our Patreon subscribers decide three different movies for us to talk about for the next episode in celebration of the Halloween season. No real rules or anything. It was just the only theme that we preferred it to be something Halloween themed. So with that being said, our first movie we'll be discussing is John Carpenter's 1981 film, The Fog, suggested by Janet DeFever. Hi, Mom. And the plot of the movie is... Strange things begin to occur as a tiny California coastal town prepares to commemorate its centennial celebration. Inanimate objects spring eerily to life as Reverend Malone stumbles upon a dark secret about the town's founding, radio announcer Stevie witnesses a mystical fire, and hitchhiker Elizabeth discovers the mutilated corpse of a fisherman. Then a mysterious iridescent fog descends upon the village and more people start to die. We're just going to loosely talk about each film for a bit in a sort of informal discussion, preferably with no big spoilers, but we'll tell you if we do. So, Eric, with that being said, what did you think of The Fog?
Yeah, so I've been curious to watch The Fog for a while. I'm a big John Carpenter fan, huge fan of The Thing, Halloween, They Live. Christine is really solid as well. I mean, I even have a poster of They Live hanging in my bathroom, which probably speaks more to me than to the type of person that I am. But huge fan of John Carpenter. Always curious to check out The Fog. And so, yeah, so I was excited to give this a watch. But yeah, I mean, OK, so I will say it's very atmospheric. It's very aesthetically pleasing. I mean, you got the iconic John Carpenter score in it. It's got a lot of pieces that should work well in theory, but yeah, oh man, from a story standpoint, with this only being 89 minutes long, it felt like the longest 89 minutes. I'm being honest, there are certain moments that are really cool that I could talk about specifically, but yeah, like the visual elements are cool. The killings are fun and whatnot, but the story is so convoluted to me, and I think it's because it's a mix of these three different storylines, which to me, I was more or less invested in one over the other. And then when another storyline got interwoven in there, I just didn't really care that much about what was going on. And so, yeah, I was kind of mixed on it, honestly, but I did like some certain elements from it. So I gave it a pass there for that, but yeah, I had some thoughts.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that boat with you too. To go back over a little backstory, I also very much enjoy John Carpenter's work. Halloween is a classic, obviously. The Thing is one of my favorite horror movies ever. It's fantastic, mm-hmm. and I hope that we discuss it at some point on this show. Christine, the movie about the killer car, I also thought was a lot of fun. Despite that really ridiculous, wacky premise, I actually think it does work, and Carpenter does take that. Gives a lot of specific tact to and dignity to this, even though it is like a very silly premise. And and yeah, I have also seen They Live. I think it's pretty fun. And then I've also seen Assault on Precinct 13. Thought it was pretty cool. I saw In the Mouth of Madness, which I think is okay. And then, yeah, The Fog is the seventh film from John Carpenter that I've seen. But yeah, I very much feel the same as you. God, this is the slowest movie I have seen in quite some time, which is wild because, like, John Carpenter is a very methodical director. There are definitely slow moments to all of his films, but I think they're more forgivable slow moments because you know they're leading up to really big moments, especially in Halloween and The Thing. That's why those two films are such classics and are really well regarded. But yeah, The Fog especially, I really wasn't as terrified by it. And I'd like to add too, my mom told me she wanted to pick this film because she watched it as a young adult and she was like really motivated and moved by it in that she thought it was very cool and really scary. I know my mom hasn't seen a ton of horror movies, but at the same time though, I really wanted to like get her perspective on what she really enjoyed about it and what she took away from it. And yeah, I will say it's very visually and shot focused. It's very specific about the angles that we're specifically trying to get of this coastal town and like trying to like piece together. So it's not really like dialogue heavy. It's very much rooted in atmosphere, but I feel like the atmosphere itself isn't rooted or really giving us a lot to go off of as far as like really exciting characters or relatable means or like really intense stakes or anything. There wasn't a lot of that moving me along from beat to beat. And, there are little things that I pointed out. I will say the story framed out of the sea captain at the beginning, telling it to the children, like I thought that was kind of a cool narrative device. And it actually gave me a lot of hope going into this movie. And I like that. I actually didn't mind that it worked out of a few different perspectives, namely the radio station. Oddly enough, it kind of reminded me of Cocaine Bear in a weird way, where there's a central antagonist that we're all trying to figure out in the meantime as all these different characters and perspectives are all leaning into another and cohabitating with each other as they try to fight a central threat. But yeah, I don't know. It the slowness really brought this down for me. There was not enough things after the fact or aside from that slowness or atmosphere that really got me invested. So yeah, was not really a big fan of this, but there are aspects that I'll talk about that I thought were pretty interesting. Was there anything specific about the film that you liked or connected with, or was it mostly just a slog?
No, I mean, there were some parts that I got more invested in than others. Actually, you mentioned the radio announcer. That's actually one of the threads that I thought I would be okay with them just focusing on that, because that was, weirdly enough, that was the one I was most invested in for whatever reason. I feel like it's just because it was just kind of cool to see the juxtaposition of the radio station, the outside world. She's trying to inform everybody about this danger that she's kind of just learning about and trying to warn everybody. I thought that was actually a pretty cool narrative, and that was the one I connected with the most personally. But I do think Jamie Lee Curtis as a hitchhiker, that was kind of fun. I mean, I didn't hate it. And I do like the setup to where, like you described in the plot, she and the one who gave her a ride were the one who discovered the dead fisherman, which I think that killing specifically was fun. I mean, it was, you know, the ghostly pirates thing. I mean, the visual elements and the killings and stuff, that was cool. And that was the highest compliment I can really pay this film, is just some of the fun, you know, elements there. You know, the lore aspect of it is kind of interesting too. And it did give me hope in the beginning. You mentioned as well about the intro was of the elderly captain telling the ghost stories around the campfire. So what's funny is I actually did some digging into this, and actually that was added after the rough cut, because after the rough cut of the movie was made, it was actually too short for the theatrical release. So John Carpenter added some more scenes like that one specifically, which I thought was kind of interesting. It kind of felt natural. It didn't feel much to me like an afterthought, which is kind of what it was. But yeah, I don't know. I thought that was kind of a cool setup.
Speaking of that, did you like notice too, the opening credits took forever to get through? Like, honestly, like I was writing it at 15 minutes that we were at 15 minutes into the movie. I was writing that the opening credits were still going and it's 95 minutes without credits. I was like kind of shocked, like how long it was taking to actually establish everything and set these things up. And it was just one of those things where I like the slowness wasn't really benefiting any greater themes or characters or anything or plights or stakes. It was just being slow for the sake of slow, and it just didn't really mesh with me.
Yeah, and I mean, I do give John Carpenter some credit on, I mean, we talked a little bit about Christine as well. A wacky premise like that, but actually making it coherent and fun and actually something that's entertaining and watchable. So, I mean, in theory, I feel like he should be able to tackle something like The Fog, because on paper, also very kind of an interesting, weird premise to begin with as well. But yeah, this is one of those instances to where I feel like it is stretched a little bit too thin, honestly. I feel like this would have worked much better as a short film or something like that. Like, I feel like, you know, it almost feels like to me that there's a specific reason why the rough cut was too short. I feel like you can only stretch this idea so far.
Yeah, it feels like it was like trying to be stretched to the full length of the film, and then they stretched it even further, and it really suffers for that.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about it too. I mean, yeah, and there are specific moments that I really like too. I mean, I guess mild spoilers, but there's a part a little bit later on during one of the, it's kind of directly after one of the killings, but basically one of the bodies comes back to life in the hospital room. And that's like kind of a fun scene, and just kind of the only sense of fear or dread I felt throughout this whole movie. The rest of it I was just kind of indifferent towards, but going along with, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, that does make sense. There are a few things that I did kind of like about this film that I do want to shout out, so my score makes a little bit more sense, and I'm not just saying, oh, it's slow and boring, fuck you, like that, anything.
Yeah.
Like that. I will say that there are some nice ocean shots. Like I said, it's very shot focused in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not really reliant on quick cuts or editing or really heavy dialogue or anything. There are, like I said, there are some nice ocean shots. The location itself is cool. I like the idea of having a horror film set in a coastal sort of beach environment in a way. I don't think we get a ton of that, so I think that's pretty cool. The score, like all of John Carpenter's work, is very distinctive. It's not something along the lines of Halloween where you're going to be humming it after or it sticks in your head or anything, but it doesn't feel carried over either. I will say it feels like it's its own score. Even if it's not super memorable, you do remember that there was a score and that it helped carry you through some of the slower moments. So I do want to give some credit to that. I did say that the story picked up a little bit when the sun actually comes out. There is a sense of trying to connect these specific stories together, and the problem is that the actual big shocking things just sort of happen out of nowhere. The buildup just isn't there where it needs to be, which is weird because Carpenter is usually good at that, where The Thing is terrific at this, where it'll be really, really quiet and really quiet, and then something insane that you were not expecting or have never seen before happens, involving claymation or blood or gore or whatever, what have you, and it makes it that much more jarring. But the big moments are there, but they're just not nearly as satisfying. And I will say, when we do get into the climax a little bit, when the fog actually starts to roll in and the creatures come out of it, it is a very cool image, and I did like seeing that, but it was just sort of a too little too late. So, sort of a rare miss for this director, in my opinion. But, I have not seen, either of the Escape films, New York or LA. I have not seen Big Trouble in Little China or Prince of Darkness. Those are the big gaps in my Carpenter filmography, but right now I would say The Fog is probably my least favorite of his. I mean, it's still not the worst thing ever. It's just kind of mediocre for this era and this time period. And I know that Carpenter had better work in him, and he proved it by doing it.
No, for sure. And that's kind of how I feel if we're looking at the macro scale and the filmography of John Carpenter. I have more catching up to do than you, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So my A tier, top tier is, you know, The Thing and Halloween for sure. They Live, I feel like, is a tier behind that. And then Christine and The Fog are kind of in the tier behind that. I mean, they're not the worst thing ever. They get by, but yeah, also not my favorite, considering the other work that he's done. But yeah, and you mentioned the coastal town and the backdrop of this film, and that's one of the highest compliments I can also pay it to. So the lighthouse that's actually used for it is the Point Reyes Lighthouse in Marin County, California. And there's this really cool shot to where it's looking down and you can see the lighthouse, you can see the ocean. And one of the first things that came to my head was, wow, that is a lot of steps to walk down to get to that lighthouse. And yeah, apparently it's 300 steps leading down to it. So I just saved you a lot of counting there. So you're welcome.
Oh, okay, good. That's good to know. I was in the middle. I was so bored that I was counting the steps, but yeah. I was like, oh shit. Okay, things are happening now. I guess I'll hopefully Eric will be counting the steps. And wow, you did.
Yeah. I know. I can't take all the credit from that. I did do my due diligence and research into this, but yeah, I thought that was interesting. I was like, that is a lot of steps. Like I just imagine working at that lighthouse, or if you happen to have a radio station there, like in the movie, it's like, man, to have that be part of your commute, to walk down 300 steps. I literally have, not to put anybody at my work on blast, but I literally will watch people at my work go down, take the elevator to go down one flight. They won't even go down one flight of stairs. And it's like, it blows my mind. It's like, it's one flight of stairs.
Yeah, I get that too, but I will say this as part of my job, not to defend elevators or anything. I don't want to go on like a huge tangent, but typically like, it's weird because where I work is that like, if to go to the first floor, you have to go outside of the building and then badge back in and then to go back into the building. So that's why I take the elevator. But regardless,
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. If you have to go, yeah, exactly. If you have to go in and around like a bunch of different steps, yeah, the elevator makes more sense. But I will say, if you're just going down an elevator, yeah, maybe just take the stairs if it's less complicated.
No, it's honest. I mean, I'm not trying to go on a big elevator tangent, but it does crack me up because I'll just see people just waiting outside for the elevator to come. And I'm just like, not even thinking twice about it. It's like 14 steps down. I'm just going to take the stairs. And then I beat them by like a few minutes. It's like, what was the point of that?
In an effort to de-escalate the conversation, bazinga, what would you give the fog?
Yeah. So if we're getting into final thoughts and all that, just to kind of wrap up what I've previously mentioned. So yeah, I agree with a lot of things of what you're saying. The fog is very atmospheric between the visual elements, coastal backdrop, and iconic John Carpenter score. I mean, the kills are fun and very memorable, and there are very memorable, shocking moments. But outside of that, the storyline's just kind of convoluted between switching between Reverend Malone, Stevie the radio announcer, and Elizabeth the hitchhiker. So there's not really a lot of momentum that could be built. It's just kind of truncated, and we switch to the next plot piece. So I'm not really attached to any of these characters. I'm just kind of watching everything unfold. So yeah, even at 89 minutes, the fog felt long, which, you know, tells me the pacing either needs to be reworked or the idea is simply spread too thin. So yeah. In short, I want less backstory and more pirate ghosts. But yeah, I'm giving the fog a 6 out of 10.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, I'm a little lower than you. I gave it a 4 out of 10. Like I said, some cool images, some cool ideas, nothing that really took me by surprise, especially by comparison to this director, like John Carpenter's other work. It's my least favorite of his films. Way too slow of pacing, not enough payoff. It just was pretty disappointing, all things considered. But I mean, John Carpenter has more than proved how much he has been able to provide to the horror genre and thriller genres over the years. So yeah, my hat's off to John Carpenter, even if I'm not super crazy on it. Well, our next movie that we're going to be discussing is Michael Reimer's 2002 film Queen of the Damned, as recommended by Tori Langlands. And the plot of the movie is, Lestat de Lioncourt is awakened from his slumber. Bored with his existence, he has now become this generation's new rot god. While in the course of time, another has arisen, Akasha, the queen of the vampires and the damned. He wants immortal fame, his fellow vampires want him eternally dead for his betrayal, and the queen wants him for her king. Who will be the first to reach him, and who shall win? So, yeah, Eric, what'd you think of this?
Oh, God. That's a loaded question.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so I do want to give a little backstory and context as well. So, so the screenplay for Queen of the Damned was by Scott Abbott and Michael Petroni, based on the 1988 novel The Queen of the Damned by Anne Rice, which is actually the third novel of the book series of Vampire Chronicles. However, the film contains many plot elements from the novel's 1985 predecessor, The Vampire Lestat. Queen of the Damned is a standalone sequel to Interview with the Vampire from 1994, which I admittedly have not seen. And I was kind of last minute with my notes putting everything together, and I was like, oh crap, and I could not squeeze it in. But yeah, I didn't realize that till it was kind of too late after the fact. But So I have also not read The Vampire Chronicles by Anne Rice or watched that 1994 film Interview with the Vampire by Neil Jordan.
Basically,
my goodness.
Basically, you went into this the coldest you could possibly be.
As cold as a vampire could be, yes.
Yeah, pretty much.
But yeah, I mean, after reading about how the film essentially took a lot of the plot elements from the second novel, The Vampire Lestat, despite the film being titled after the third novel of the series, I mean, I got the impression it strays pretty far from the source material anyway. But yeah, I mean, and that kind of sums up my thoughts even before I read all of this. This film is a mess. It's like, it actually had the potential to be so much more on paper, because there are some things that actually are pretty cool about the setup or you know, some people involved with the project. And I mean, it's a pretty killer soundtrack. If you're into the new metal scene, it's a pretty killer soundtrack. I mean, it's got Jonathan Davis everywhere. Who's the lead singer of Korn, for anyone who's not a new metalhead like me. But there are a lot of fun elements to where I feel like this could have worked really well if they could have just executed it correctly, but it's a hot mess. And honestly, if we're talking about something that's really hard to sit through, my God, this was even harder than The Fog to sit through. I was getting so impatient.
Okay.
And just, I don't know, for whatever reason, it dragged so much for me after a while. It really did. But
yeah, because here's the thing. Okay,
yeah.
So a few things I want to say. Tori is a close friend of mine. She picked this movie, and admittedly, like, when I asked her, hey, what do you want to pick for your Patreon pick? She told me this film, and I was like, oh, cool. I'm excited to watch this finally. I know doesn't have a great reputation, but maybe I'll like it. And she literally responded, this movie is not good. I'm picking it because it's funny. And I was like, okay, boom, even better. So I had a feeling that this was the kind of reputation that preceded this film. I also did not realize in my research that this was a standalone sequel to Neil Jordan's 1994 Interview with the Vampire, starring Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, which is actually a good movie. I watched it for Halloween last year, and I had a blast with it. It's very fun. Here's some quotes from my review. The big things that I remember a year later, I wrote, it's absolutely inane camp nonsense, shot and handled with the utmost care, technique, and precision, which is the biggest compliment I could provide to it. It has some of the most transparently homoerotic overtones I've ever seen in a movie, let alone a film with two really big macho machismo, like main A-list actors in it. I thought that was pretty ballsy for 1994, a time that was not the most gay friendly, especially compared to what, 25, almost 30 years later. So respect for that. And Cruise, Pitt, and Dunst were all great. I remember being really affected by Dunst's performance. Especially when you consider, I don't know, like, one of the big things I took away from her, I wrote down that her performance oddly reminded me of Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver, which again is a big compliment. So, had a lot of fun with it. I gave it a 7, closer to an 8 than a 6. I would definitely watch it again, and I would recommend it to anybody. It's definitely one of my favorite vampire films I think I've ever seen. As someone that has... Honestly, I didn't think I had seen that many, but I watched a lot of different like vampire films for my Halloween challenge this year. And I still really enjoy that film, and I would definitely come back to it in the near future. Yeah, so that's a plus on its own, is that this definitely doesn't ruin that film's legacy. It just feels like a really cheap cash grab trying to be really really trend hoppy, and like, it's very rooted in affinity for this dated goth look and style, like a lot of Hot Topic sort of influence that goes into it. Like you said, Korn's Jonathan Davis does all the music for this movie. It's very funny, and it does not match at all what a newly awakened Lestat would be into at all musically.
No.
Like, when I think of like a vampire coming into modern music, I feel like it would make more sense for him to be into something like New Order or David Bowie or The Cure or something along those lines, and not...
Yeah.
And I didn't expect him to be like, ooh, 3 Days Grace, nice. Like something like that. I didn't expect that. Part of it at all. Like, and it's weird too, because everyone immediately latches onto his image almost like with this Marilyn Manson sort of fascination and outrage, when it's just so fucking corny and goofy. And yeah, it's really, really strange. And like, the plot itself is just oddly very complicated. And that, I think, is what my disconnect was with this film more than anything. Like, I can get into a film and watch it, like, anytime if it's, like, goofy and vapid in a fun way. Like, I watched Jason X for the for last night, which is a worse movie than this. But that was my fourth time watching that movie. And it was just so goofy and weird and dated in its own unique way. But you can always stay with it and know what's going on. But this film is oddly, like, very complicated for what it is, with, like, the main character trying to decipher how to put himself back, put him back in Lestat meeting Akasha. There's just, like, so many different threads, and we're constantly being pulled in and out of this book that the main investigator is trying to figure out. It's just such a complicated movie when Interview with the Vampire is so easy to keep track of. Like, it's just boom, like, vampires are in the modern world, and we're using it as a framing device to tell a story. Boom, that's all you need. So honestly, like, nothing's really fun or convincing. It's just really lame and stupid. And it is funny. I had fun watching it I will say, this is also the only movie out of the three that I did not watch sober. And that's all I'll say. my roommate and I threw this on, so my memory on it is a little foggy, but I did take notes to the best of my ability in trying to keep track of everything. So yeah, all I can say really about this film is that I'd recommend just watching Interview with the Vampire from 1994. It's a legitimately good movie, and it's easy to find on streaming services. So those are the big takeaways that I would add.
For sure. And would you say that watching the Interview with the Vampire first, would that improve your experience with Queen of the Damned at all, or make it easier to follow in any way? Or it sounds like it didn't.
It did not. Honestly, like, I went into Interview with the Vampire just kind of seeing that it had, like, a pretty good, like, score on Letterboxd, and I was like, oh, like, I like Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, and I like all these performers, and it has a good reputation, and it paid off in the ways that I was hoping it would. Where this, I just kind of expected, oh, it's just kind of a silly vampire movie, even if I didn't know. Honestly, I went into this not even knowing that it was connected to Interview with the Vampire. I just kind of assumed it was going to be, like, a weird vampire movie that had some dated stuff in it that, like, really leaned hard into that new metal culture at the time, and it was funny for that reason. And it was. Honestly, I don't even know. Like, this movie was funny to watch with my roommate, but I don't know if I would go back to it anytime soon, where there are other bad, funny, dated movies that are more fun than this.
Yeah, and honestly, the tone was kind of all over the place for me because, I mean, I did catch myself laughing at different things, but I don't think I was supposed to be laughing. I think it was just very sloppy execution, and that's why I was laughing, but... Like, it wasn't really trying to intentionally be funny necessarily. And so, yeah, it was it was an experience for sure. I mean, and I know Anne Rice has spoken out about the film, the author of the book series, because originally she kind of stood behind the project in that, you know, they were approaching it with care. But there was definitely a big disconnect if you look into the behind the scenes aspects of it. Like, she was pretty removed from the project, and she wasn't really involved much at all, and basically offered to write the screenplay, but they wouldn't, you know, take her up on it or wouldn't do it. So there was
really, that's,
it was weird. I may be a little off, cause I don't have this like written verbatim in my notes or anything, but I remember reading the backstory and research on it. It was very strange. Like, yeah, at first she was for the project and was just like, okay, like, I think they're going to do it justice. But then she saw the end result. She only watched it one time and has not watched it since. And basically after the fact, it's just like, yeah, don't, like, it's basically, I'm paraphrasing, I'm sure, but basically saying they massacred her work, which I'm without reading her work, I'm sure awesome. They did. So if that gives you any indication, which I know she was saying, something that's essential to make this film succeed is to get Lestat's backstory, which is mentioned in the second film, but they basically didn't use that. And they just kind of skipped right to the meat and potatoes in the third without developing that first, which I think, you know, did not help them in the execution at all. Because I do think if we got more of a backstory on Lestat or something, I probably would have been more invested in this, but it's just kind of a mess with all the different plot threads. And I think you summed it up pretty well there. It just feels like a cash grab. Like, they have very competent actors and actresses involved, and, you know, you got Jonathan Davis all over everything for the soundtrack. I mean, how can it not succeed? But,
Oh my God.
And I got specific thoughts and takeaways I can do from specific moments, but oh my God. I mean, okay. I will say there is a really fun Jonathan Davis cameo that's kind of unexpected and is pretty fun. Him as a scalper. I got some enjoyment out of that. It was pretty funny. Oh, but dear God, I mean, something that could be the climax of this film and something that should be much more powerful than it is, this big spectacle concert of Lestat's rock band and everything. Then he opens his mouth and it's fucking Jonathan Davis's voice. And I about wanted to throw my TV out the window.
It's such a mismatch. It's such a mismatch, honestly. Like, you expect him to have like a glam rock sort of like exterior that like leans into, I don't know, that leans into goth or like some sort of like an external music. I don't know, just some sort of an outsider music perspective, not like new metal, like mainstream butt rock sort of thing. Like it's just like very, very big disconnect, and it leads to a really inauthentic experience. Like, especially 20 years later, like it feels very, very dated because of that. So I honestly don't think I would watch this again, even ironically again. I feel like it wasn't worth like the stupid shit that we were put through. But I mean, there are worse movies. I mean, fuck, listen to our last episode on Megan is Missing, like a way worse movie than this.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, and I feel like a mother saying this, but I literally wrote in my notes, I'm not mad, just disappointed. And I feel like that
it's a great way to describe it. Also, speaking of it, the last thing I want to say is that the queen, Kasia, the queen of the damned, she's the titular role. It was performed by a pop star, Aaliyah. She had a couple of hits in like the late 90s, early 2000s. This was her final performance before she unfortunately died in a plane crash when she was 22, which is a real shame, especially when you look up what a difficult life she had and how much she was like abused in the music industry too. Like I really feel for her.
God,
and it sucks that had to happen. So rest in peace, but yeah, movie itself, not good.
I know. You know, I'm really glad you mentioned that too. So yeah, I know Aaliyah is actually one of the highlights, I think, of this film. I think she does well for the role that she's in. And it's a shame that the movie itself sucks because this was like her last project. It was really a shame. I was actually just listening to Aaliyah earlier today, throwing out her music and just kind of getting a nostalgic trip from it. But oh my God, like she was so talented. Like
very
she had an amazing
so.
Voice. And it's like, it is honestly such a shame.
Yeah. But with that being said, what is your score for Queen of the Damned?
So getting into my final thoughts on it and everything, given the cast and musicians contributing to the soundtrack, Queen of the Damned had so much potential. Sadly, through a mix of incompetent pacing, laughable visual effects and audio mixing, in a weak storyline, this is a vampire film I just couldn't sink my teeth into. And for that, I'm giving Queen of the Damned a 4 out of 10.
Yeah, completely understandable. I myself gave it a 3 out of 10. I had fun laughing at it in the moment, but I don't really remember much going back from it. It's like I said, tone and style all over the place. There's an inauthentic quality to the music being so far removed from what you would expect a vampire to really get into as far as like a serpent-y rock god sort of way. None of the performances are really that great. It's campy and weird, but not in a good enough way. But I would recommend Interview with the Vampire by Neil Jordan from 1994. Actually good movie. 7 out of 10 would recommend for sure. So
nice. Yeah, and I'm definitely going to have to go back and do my due diligence and watch that one because I'm much more interested in that compared to this. But I guess I'm at least glad to know that it wouldn't have really helped my experience much even going into it for this film. As far as like, I guess what I'm saying is you still had a hard time following the story even watching that beforehand. So I was like, is it just me or is this just kind of very convoluted and just, I don't know. There's a lot going on here and I had to really focus and pay attention. Yeah.
Eric, I have incredible news. It's not just you.
Okay, perfect. Well, hey, that is very reassuring. Thank you.
There you go. And our final movie, quote unquote, it's more of a special, but we're just going to roll with it. Our final movie we'll be talking about is Phil Vischer's 1993 special, VeggieTales, Where's God When I'm Scared? Recommended by Reed Lott. This is the first VeggieTales short film which deals with Junior's fear of monsters, while the second story is a retelling of the Bible story of Daniel and the Lion's Den. So, Eric, we were actually talking about, before we started rolling on the podcast, we were actually talking about our connection to VeggieTales prior to going into this special. I myself watched VeggieTales not a lot. I definitely knew people that watched VeggieTales more than I did growing up. Basically, if you were in more of a religious background, I grew up religious. I grew up Catholic. I don't really identify as Catholic really anymore, but it was definitely the church's answer to having something to distract kids or to not even distract kids. I would give VeggieTales a little bit more credit than that. I feel like VeggieTales serves its purpose well as a sort of, it's a good introductory way to teach kids morals that are related to religion and Christianity that tie into the Christian Bible itself. But yeah, I don't really have any sort of major beef with VeggieTales as far as like, I don't really consider it to be religious propaganda or anything like that in most mm-hmm. ways. I mean, they're not really saying like, if you don't believe this, you're going to hell or any of the weird right. sort of stuff that I feel like Christian agenda sort of pushes, especially on kids and confuses kids and gives them like weird opinions and anxieties growing up. I didn't really feel that with VeggieTales. I just thought it was like, oh, hey, like we are trying to capitalize on, like a means of introducing kids to religion in a fun way. And I don't really have a problem with that. But yeah, what was your background with VeggieTales growing up?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that. So I actually did grow up in a, you know, religious household and everything. Like church was always part of my I always went to church and everything growing up, and it became yeah. part of my adult life and everything as well. So I grew up in that kind of environment. And surprisingly, I never really like had any experience with VeggieTales still, which is strange because I feel like that'd be yeah. the perfect environment for it. I grew up during the time period of when it was starting to gain popularity, and I grew up in the church and everything, but for whatever reason, it was just never on my radar, and I'm not really sure why. I would hear people watching about it, but never really watched it or had any experience with it prior to this. But yeah, so I went into it with no expectations based on that. But yeah, I think you summed it up well to where there's a lot that can easily go wrong with any sort of religious driven media that's for kids or anything like that. It can fall into that propaganda category real quick. But I feel like they toe that line pretty well, all things considered, for this, especially for a Halloween-ish episode with this. It would have been so easy for them to be like, oh, don't celebrate Halloween or don't dress up like this. Yeah. This is all demonic. You're going to hell for this. Like, they don't do anything like that. It's just, if you're scared, you know, they offer you the security blanket that is God and all this stuff, which is, you know, that's the positive way to look at it. And it's very harmless, innocent, you know, gives kids hope and everything. I don't think there's anything wrong with what they were doing. I think they served their purpose and they weren't being overly preachy with stuff, which is difficult to do. So I give them credit for that.
And I also want to mention too, I find that very interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's actually kind of wild that not only was this was VeggieTales' first release special ever. It came back out. Yeah. It came out in 1993. So this preceded the first like Pixar film. Like this preceded Toy Story.
Yeah.
And they did Halloween first, which like you were implying, this is definitely one of the most contentious holidays between those that are religious and secular. Like I grew up with a lot of friends who grew up in very religious backgrounds that were not even able to watch like Harry Potter or Halloween Town or things that are definitely fine for kids. Like it might be a little scary depending on how old you are and what your background is, but really like so much Halloween media for children is so tame and sanitized already that I mm-hmm. find it interesting that they went off of this right off the bat. I will say that the special does feel a little one for you, one for me in a way, like you mm-hmm. give one with the traditional Halloween elements with the Franken celery, which is a cute pun, I will admit. and then you have literally a retelling of the biblical story of Daniel in the lion's den. And so I find that kind of interesting that there's sort of a relationship that the creators of VeggieTales were trying to draw between being centered in reality and being centered in having religious beliefs, like being, like I said, religion versus being secular. And I find that interesting about VeggieTales as a property. And can I say, too, The animation for CGI in 1993, I don't think it's that bad. It's obviously dated, but and it's of the time, I don't think most people would have raised an eyebrow at it. It only makes Rhapsody Street Kids look even more shitty, which is horrible movie that we talked about, a horrible holiday special we talked about last year in December, which looks like dog shit. And that came out 9 years after this movie came out.
Yeah. God, I know. And that one looks like it's 20 years in the past somehow or something. But yeah, no, I actually paid compliments to that, to the animation for VeggieTales, especially with this being the first episode. I think the animation was actually pretty solid, especially given the time period. I think my only beef with the, at least with the first segment, if we're focusing on that.
Sure.
So I think the songs need to be reworked a little bit because for the first segment, they're just kind of clunky. They're too slow. They're not really catchy, but that's just kind of my opinion of them. But yeah, I mean, but I will say for that first episode specifically, I think what they do well in it though, like what I was saying before, is they don't really condemn kids for doing anything wrong. They keep it simple. They make it relatable. I mean, how many kids out there have watched something scary late at night and they couldn't sleep at night and they're seeing things and, you know, that's a very relatable thing. I mean, so they take that idea and they run with it and they make it fun. I kind of liked, I did get some enjoyment. I laughed a little bit too about the Frankenseller who was like, I'm just an actor from Toledo. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, it's cute. It's cute and funny. Yeah. I liked it. Yeah. It's nice for kids. And I don't really have an issue with it. Also, I want to say two things about the moral of the first story that I want to add. Like the moral of the story of the first one is that even if you're scared of something, remember that God is bigger than them. And the first thing I thought going off of our last episode, if only Larry and Bob were able to tell that to Megan and Amy.
Yeah. Oh, God. The crossover we never knew we needed.
Even if you're scared of people kidnapping you and torturing you and eventually burying you, like, hey, remember, God is bigger than that guy. So you shouldn't be worried, honestly. And also another thing, too, I also kind of interpret this moral as you shouldn't fear anything but God. Which is my overly analytical brain sort of just working itself a little too hard.
Yeah.
But not a big deal. It doesn't ruin it anything. We also, in between these two segments, we have Silly Songs with Larry, which is just like a little in-between filler thing. And I don't really have any. This was the Water Buffalo song, which is definitely one of the most famous VeggieTales songs. And I actually kind of like that this song is how meta this song is. I like that it's like that the asparagus comes in and it's like, no, you can't do that. You can't promise that to people. Okay, stop the song. Stop the song. I actually thought that was kind of cute.
I actually got some enjoyment out of that. That was probably my favorite song that they did. It's wacky, it's goofy, but I like that it's very self-aware of that. And then then Archibald Asparagus comes in like a hammer. It's like, you can't do that. You can't promise. That's an absurd idea.
Like
that's
a
you know, that's a false statement. Like, I don't know, add some realism to it. I thought that was funny. And then Larry just completely does not get the message, starts singing, Everybody's Got a Baby Kangaroo, which just fires up Archibald Asparagus again. It was funny. It was cute.
Yeah, it is. It's funny. And I like that it breaks up the two segments. And then we have Daniel and the Lion's Den. And the first thing I wrote down was, now it's time for some religious propaganda, baby.
Yeah, let's go.
Did you have any big thoughts on this segment? It's basically a retelling with like some jokes thrown in. I think I like the first bit a little bit more than this. But again, it's just a direct telling of it.
Yeah. And I mean, still given that it's a very direct retelling, I still think they do a good job with it of simplifying the idea and making it digestible for kids. Okay, so my only beef with it the only beef with it that I wrote in my notes is that, okay, this is called VeggieTales, but one of the guards is a pear. Come on. Absolutely ridiculous. I had to like pause it and verify it. It's like, that's a pear. This is VeggieTales. What are you doing?
Hey, Eric, it's apparent they didn't do their research.
I know. And like, and I even had to like, I was questioning everything. I was like, wait a minute. I was like, tomato, or it's like, tomato's technically a fruit too. And I'm like, VeggieTales is just a lie.
Exactly. Like, way to break that commandment so early in your series, guys. Jesus.
I know. The whole series.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is a
I mean,
lie.
Shoot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Come on. But so what I did find pretty interesting, though, is that I watched this off YouTube, which I'm sure you did as well. But apparently I was doing some more research into it. And then I don't know if this just didn't get put in the YouTube video, but apparently there is an intro and an outro for this episode beyond this. So apparently there's an intro before the whole Halloween segment where it begins on a countertop where Bob reads a letter from Lucy Anderson of Phoenix, Arizona, who's scared because she sometimes thinks there's a monster in her closet. And then Bob asks her to watch a story about when Junior Asparagus got scared. And then they introduce the segment, which I think is actually like a more logical, like it makes so much more sense now. I feel like that's a much more logical setup than the way of, you know, finding it after the fact on YouTube. So I do give us more credit for that because I think that ties everything together, makes it a lot more cohesive that way. Instead of just my over analytical brain watching this, thinking this is flat out first episode, first introduction to these characters. It's this just Junior Asparagus watching a scary movie, shit in his pants in his room, and then all of a sudden a tomato and a cucumber come out of nowhere. It's like, I would fucking shit my pants so fast at this. But I'm glad that it's like the setup makes so much more sense now knowing that. Cause like, God, this is terrifying.
Exactly. I will say this though, like as far as establishing context in the VeggieTales universe, this is the, like I said, first special they've ever done. It makes me think, how are you getting that letter?
Like, yeah. Exactly.
How did you make contact with this Phoenix, with this person from Phoenix writing in? It's like, how do they know to ask you that question?
I know. Now I have so many more questions, I guess, knowing this.
I know. So I know.
Digging myself in a bigger hole, but
I know. Hey, if I've learned anything from religion, questioning is a good thing.
Hey, there we go.
Boom.
But yeah, but no, it was I mean, all things considered, I thought it was fine. I mean, yeah, especially that third segment and everything. I feel like the songs work better in that third segment too. They present the story in a fun way. Obviously, they don't give the exact story of everything and they keep a lot of the violence and the backstory out of it, but they give you kind of the basic idea. So I think it's serving its purpose and they're doing what they're intending to do. They're not being overly preachy with it or sending mixed signals or making things confusing or doing any propaganda. I wasn't really offended by any of this. I think it was a very simplistic telling of the story, which is,
it is the most
all you can really ask for,
thing.
You know?
Like, even parents who are very skeptical and hesitant of showing any media to their kids, this is probably the safest thing you could ever show your kids. And not even because it has a religious background. It's because it's, like, so sanitized and so safe, and it's totally okay. I will say I did not realize the second half was going to be mostly music. I wrote down, it truly is the Les Miserables of CGI Christian vegetable direct-to-DVD releases. So good on them for that.
All right.
I thought when the scallions put Larry into the hole to be eaten by the lions, I thought that perspective shot is very Silence of the Lambs. I thought that was pretty fun. It is a retelling. There really isn't anything outside of them being vegetables that makes it special, which is why I like the first one a little more. I think there's a little bit more creativity. That's pretty much all I had on it. First half is a little better than the second, but it's pretty inoffensive. And yeah, I could see why. I can see the validity of liking this as a child.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the setup is still good. I mean, they establish the characters and make something a little more fun in the beginning before getting into the meat and potatoes and doing actual scripture type stuff at the end, which I think is the right way to do it. You don't want to come out swinging with full on scripture and propaganda and stuff. You want to have like a little fun, relatable sketch to kind of introduce these characters and get the kids a little interested, invested in it. And you have the segments kind of breaking things up. So it's not too much of a slog or anything. And even with anyone with a short attention span can get through that. So I think it serves its job. And I think it's, you know, definitely a serviceable debut for sure. And obviously set things in motion for things to come. So, you know, they only continue to have success after that.
Exactly. By the way, instead of calling it propaganda, can we call it cropaganda? Because
my God, that's I'm kind of mad I didn't think of that first. Oh my God.
And I'm happy I did.
Yeah, you know, I'm not taking that away from you. That was great. I'm glad it was said, regardless.
Holy my Lord. All right, cool. Well, Eric, what is your final score on VeggieTales Where's God When I'm Scared?
So Where's God When I'm Scared is a respectable debut and finds a way to offer valuable lessons for kids without being too preachy or cringeworthy. The humor is effective in large part. The music is very hit or miss, but overall it's serviceable. And not Cropaganda. So I give it a 5 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat with you too. You know what? I'm gonna go.
yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I'm in that same field with you too. I would give this a 5 out of 10 as well. Not because it's like bad by any means. Like I'd recommend it to the right audience. I mean, it's definitely good for kids who find value in religion or parents who want to give their kids an introduction to what they find special about religion and teaching your kids some good morals. Because really, like, I will say this about, even if I'm not very religious today, I still am very thankful I grew up religious, because I think religion in some capacities does keep you on the straight and narrow. It does give you some good ideas. It does teach you some basic life lessons and empathy and being good to one another, like all the basic stuff. So I'm glad that this movie leans into more of that angle than, like you said, being preachy or cringy, because it could have been very easy, as we've seen through so much religious media, that you can be very religious and you can be very preachy and you can be very cringy by doing that. So the fact that this movie doesn't, I give a lot of credit to. So 5 out of 10, good for the right audience. But if I'm judging it just as a special, 5 out of 10. But I will say there are better, in my memory from being 7 or 8 years old, there are better VeggieTales specials that exist outside of this one. So maybe dig a little deeper, maybe dig into that Christmas one with the Larry the toy. I think that one was pretty cute. So there you go. 5 out of 10. Pretty cute.
Nice. Yeah. VeggieTales definitely plants the seeds so they can see the harvest. And that is a wife swap reference. And I'm so glad I squeezed that in there. Oh my
God. If there was one thing this episode was missing, it was a wife swap reference.
Yes.
Very much so. Well, Eric, before we get into what we're doing for the next couple of episodes, do you want to explain what you're going to be up to for the month of November?
Yeah, so life in general. So yeah, so long story short, I bought a house a little over a year ago and thought for sure, it's like, yeah, you know, I'm going to fix things up and I'm going to be renting out a portion of it. It'd be good to go just in a few months' time. Life happens, all this stuff, projects happen, and it has been taking me much longer than expected to just knock these things out. Finally, I've been making some headway recently, but it's just one of those things where I'm like, okay, I need to limit all the projects and stuff I'm doing. If I just get a month or so to just knock these things out and just get this thing good to go, so it's off my conscience, off my plate. I should really take the opportunity to do that. So yeah, I will be stepping away for the month of November, coming in hot in December though, because I do not want to miss any Christmas specials. So
very cool. Okay.
Just saw you to hear that from me and everything. Obviously going to miss everything, but I'm not going to be gone forever. I am just doing this so I can get life responsibilities under control with this house and everything and get that all situated. So that's another project off my plate that I can knock out and sleep a little better at night knowing that that is taken care of. So yeah, that is it in a nutshell.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, if VeggieTales has taught me anything, it's all love and respect. So totally understandable. Yeah, well, yeah, your seat will be here when you get back. With that being said, we are going to be having guest hosts for the next two episodes of Films for the Void. And Eric will be back in December for our holiday episodes. With that being said, I am pleased to announce our first guest will be none other than Charlie Mangan. You may remember him from back on our bonus episode, where I interviewed him. We talked about Beastie Boys. We talked about the Oscars. We had an amazing time and we're having him back on for the next episode. And he's going to pick the anniversary pick and I'm going to be picking the next main topic movie per his ask. And we decided to pick a movie that we both have a lot of love for in the silliest, most earnest way possible. It was one of my favorite films as a kid and Charlie shared that same sentiment, especially when it features an actor fresh off the heels of a deserved win at last year's Oscars. So what better way to celebrate the Renaissance than by talking about Sam Weissman's 1997 film, George of the Jungle, which you can currently stream on Disney+.
Nice. Yeah, you guys will definitely be in good hands with Charlie for that episode. I listened to that bonus episode a little while back, and you guys had great chemistry. It was a great conversation, everything. And man, yeah, George of the Jungle is such a great pick too. So I'm excited to listen to that.
Hell yeah. Very much. Yeah, very much appreciate that. So if you don't want to be spoiled for Sam Weissman's 1997 film, George of the Jungle, watch it before the next episode. These episodes out, these episodes come out every 2 weeks, and we'll be having a full spoiler discussion. And that is it. Thank you all so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe to Films for the Void wherever you're streaming this episode. You can follow us on Twitter at @films_void. You can follow me, Landon, on Twitter at @IGotDaFeverMan, on Instagram at DaFever, D-U-H Fever, and on Letterboxd at Landon DaFever. You can follow Eric on Twitter and Letterboxd at Eric with the Hair, and on Instagram at Eric with the Beard. And just as a reminder, you can access early episodes and the chance to pick an upcoming movie discussion for just $3 a month over at patreon.com/films_void. Eric, before we wrap up, do you have anything else you want to add?
I think I covered my bases. I'm just looking forward to coming back in December with hopefully the housing project done. But yeah, through God, all things are possible, right? If VeggieTales taught us anything.
Well, yeah, where's God when I'm trying to finish my project?
Yeah, exactly. The special I never knew I needed.
I'm sure God will be watching over you this next month, as I'm sure he'll be watching over Charlie and I. So with that being said, thank you all so much for listening, and we will see you in the next episode. Take care.
See ya.